and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales and anecdotes and uncovering stories never told before. Without any further ado, the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you today?
I'm great, my man. Doing just fine. Got my horse all saddled up and ready to do another one, my man. We had a great one last week and a lot of response from it, and looking forward to getting this one ready.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ron, before we get going on anything, I want to tell everyone about the latest Super Studcast out now for patrons of the Studcast at patreon.com/studcast. We have a major guest, this being the universal heartthrob, Austin Idol. You get to hear the Tennessee Stud and the Idol go for almost an hour and a half. This is a lot of fun. It's also some real deep stuff. You hear about the plane crash. You hear about what it was like to go through the snake pit. But then again, we also get to hear lots of other fun stuff. This is one of the greatest Super Studcasts yet. Check it out today. It's available right now, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. We'll have more about that later in the show. But Ron, before we get going with today's episode, I know last week was a little bit different. It was out of the normal sequential order of the Studcast, where we go in chronological order of your history and the history of Southeastern Wrestling. But it was an important episode to you, and I know it was an important episode to the listeners because we've heard so much about it.
Yeah, we had tremendous response from last week's program, and that was a special tribute that we did to Harley Race, which I really felt I wanted to do very badly because I loved Harley so much and felt very strongly about him as a person. And so, I kind of wanted to, for those fans, I know it that was not, as you said, like in our normal Studcast sequences, but this was a special program because of his untimely death. And obviously, anybody out there that's a Harley fan, and if you happen to have missed this and you want to check it out, feel free to do so tnstud.com, iTunes, wherever you get your podcast from. And at the same time, feel free for you fans out there that are, just into the program. If you want to tell your friends about this one, that's a great one. I think it's really it's a unique Studcast. And we're back today, basically, to where we were 2 weeks ago.
Well, where were we and where are we going today?
Okay, we're going to pick back up where we left off a couple of weeks ago. We're going to go back to Memphis. We're going to Chattanooga. We're going to Louisville, Kentucky. We're basically finishing up for Jarrett in the summer of 1975. But we're going to start digging a few Indian artifacts in Manchester, Tennessee. we're going to do a little bit of everything today. We're going to be digging holes in the ground and we're also going to be lighting things up in some places, and we'll review Southeastern cards and results and the TV. And for the first time ever, we're going to talk payoffs for Southeastern's very first 3-day weekend. And that's basically what this one is going to be about, is that Southeastern Wrestling's first 3-day weekend, and it began on June, the weekend of June 20th, 1975. And so, you know, let's just jump right into it, Brian. If you're ready to roll, my man, the horse here, he's about to take off running here. I'm going to let him go. So we're going to begin today with final matches for Jerry Jarrett in Memphis and Louisville. And after that, June the 9th, 1975, Southern title loss. I've lost the title after months as champion to the Mongolian Stomper. I described the two episodes ago. That's basically where we were. We talked as that match on June the 9th. And I worked Memphis on June 16th and 23rd of 1975. Both matches were for the Southern title, and they were at that point owned by the Stomper. And I said last week that the Stomper won both those matches, or the last 2 weeks ago, that the Stomper won both of those matches with the help of his manager, Bearcat Wright. And the thing that really stood out for me was the size of the crowds for these two matches that I would have in Memphis. And it would be the last two I'm going to have there until I return again on September 9th, 1975. The June 16th attendance in Mid-South Coliseum was 9,368 rabid fans, which they had, the wild fans. And the following Monday, the 23rd, was more than 9,000. There were very few cities in the United States at this time frame, back in 75, that were packing them in on a weekly basis at that level. Cities like Houston, St. Louis, Madison Square Garden, New York City. But Houston is the only one of those three as an example that ran on a weekly basis. The others didn't run on a weekly basis. And then you can draw a little bigger crowds if you're not running weekly. But when you're starting to pack them in like that on a weekly basis, it's pretty spectacular. It's quite likely that Memphis during this time period might have been the number one drawing weekly city in the world from March through June of 1975. Actually, during those months, we drew more than 10,000 average every week in Memphis for that entire period of time, almost 4-month period of time. So bear in mind that during that 4-month period I just mentioned, from basically March to June of 1975, that Jerry Lawler, their traditional Memphis star, was not on any of those cards. And I did not have the numbers for the attendance in Memphis after I left there. On June the 23rd is my last show in Memphis. But I do know that they couldn't have risen. The crowds couldn't have been much bigger because the building would just not hold many more fans than over that 10,000 a show we were drawing back in that time frame. We were really busting some butt in Memphis. And I said, and I kind of backed that statement up, I believe Memphis was probably the best drawing city in America during that time frame. Then there are two more things about this huge attendance run that really stand out to me. During this remarkable run, from my first appearance on December 2nd, 1975 in Memphis until the last on June 23rd, 1975, I never once wrestled live or did a live interview on Memphis TV. That, to me, is just remarkable. I mean, I don't know that that's ever been done before. And then I added a second thing to that. I had changed from heel to babyface during that same time frame. So part of that I drew as a heel, and the other part I drew as a babyface. Now, I know for a fact that those two things combined had never, ever happened in the history of Memphis before or after. I had established myself as a superstar in Memphis during this run, and I was always going to be able to help them in that city by adding me to any card from 1975 until I retired from the ring in 1988. If they put me on that Memphis card, they could expect a pretty good crowd because I had really gotten over during that time frame.
Ron, we've talked so much about the matches you've worked in Memphis. Talk about actually working in Memphis. Did you enjoy the ring? Did you enjoy the Mid-South Coliseum? What was it like in that building for you? Talk a little bit about actually wrestling in Memphis in the Mid-South Coliseum.
It was a great venue. One of the best venues you have ever wrestled in. I love those buildings that are round. You know, you got the rectangular buildings or a square-shaped building. It doesn't have the atmosphere that a round building has. That Mid-South Coliseum was over 11,000. You could put in 11,004, 11,005. That's a pretty darn nice sized building and a hell of a crowd when you have wrestling fans that are loud anyway. It was very inspiring to wrestle in there. It was one of those goosebump cities that, you know, I get into that comeback there and boy, big goosebumps would come up a lot of times. Those fans would really rock you. So I would do my best to rock them, but sometimes they would really rock me. I mean, they're bound to be able to hear them downtown there, you know, and that building is not right downtown Memphis, but I don't know how far away that noise came out of that building, but it was a spectacular venue to work in. I love that place. Got a real good feeling from Memphis during that early part of 1975.
How were the rings? How were the rings in the Mid-South Coliseum?
Very good ring. They had an excellent ring. In fact, the ring was made by my dad in the late 50s. And it was still a fabulous ring. It was one of the first steel ones that dad made. And he never changed his style of ring. And it was copied by everyone that made wrestling rings across the country and around the world. If they wanted to have a great ring that made a lot of noise, that was pretty easy when to take big bumps on, they would find one of dad's rings and they would design them, I mean, identical to those, because they were all just fantastic rings. So yeah, rings were great. The building was great. The design of the building was great. The crowd was fantastic and so into it. They loved their wrestling in Memphis. It was a great place to be able to go and work.
Well, like you said before, what was unique about your run there was you never appeared live in the studio on the television show. It was always something taped at the arena, either a match or an interview. And at the top of the show, you talked about some of the other towns in your grandfather's territory that you would end up working on your way out. They knew you in those towns because of the tapes of those matches in Memphis, correct?
That's correct. You know, because they were recording my Coliseum matches in Memphis, like you were talking about, and showing them back on that TV. And that TV was being bicycled around to other cities in the South. So wherever they showed that TV, if I was a star, and I was always the star on the program, they really took care of me, obviously, because I was on top most every night. I was a huge star in Louisville, just like I was in Memphis. And I had never done it. I'd only worked Louisville 7 times, I think, in the entire year of 1975. And my last show in Louisville was on June 17th, 1975. It was also a return match with a Stomper for a Southern title. Jarrett wanted me to put Stomper over in every city, the major cities that he had, and I had no problem in doing that. And with each one of these finishes in that last week that I was traveling around and working shows in Memphis and in Louisville and Chattanooga and doing jobs, the Bearcat Wright was the manager, was the one that was getting the wins for his man. And that worked out good for me. And it also took better care of me. If they had just beaten me, it had been one thing. But they let the manager get involved and they made the manager actually beat me rather than Stomper himself. And I appreciated the way that they had handled that. Louisville also on that night of June 17, 75 sold out. And bear in mind, on April 1st, 1975, I was a heel. And on this last one in June, I was a baby face. So the time before they saw me in Louisville, I was a heel and I come back as a baby face and sells out again. Like I said, only been there 7 times. Every one of those 7 nights in Louisville were sellouts. My last show for the Nashville office, where my grandfather Roy and his partner Nick Gulas were owners, was in Chattanooga, Tennessee on June 28, 1975. I had not wrestled there since March 11th, when I successfully defended my Southern title against Jackie Fargo way back in the winter of the same year. I'd wrestled there, same as in Louisville, only 7 times since my arrival in Tennessee. Bear in mind, Chattanooga, they had never seen me wrestle live on their TV show either, which aired on Saturdays, and I couldn't work it because I had Knoxville to take care of. I think they ran a tape from Memphis on that Chattanooga show that Saturday afternoon, showing my loss to the Southern title, loss of the title to the Stomper, and an interview that I sent in from Knoxville that I made the Saturday before to promote that match that night that I'm wrestling Stomper for the title again, a return match. I worked with him and to get him over in many cities because they wanted him. they wanted, and again, Stomper won with the help of his manager, Bearcat Wright. Same thing in Chattanooga. I have no idea how they've been drawing since March 11th show. That was the last time I was there in Chattanooga. But on June 28th, they sold out again. And I remember talking to the Stomper in the dressing room before we went out to the ring. And he, like every other wrestler, had already gone out and taken a look at the crowd. And he told me that night, he said, "Ron, this is the biggest crowd I have seen in Chattanooga since I came here." And Chattanooga, like most Knoxville, I mean, most Tennessee cities, did very well at the box office. And no matter who the promoter was, including Nick Gulas, he couldn't even kill Chattanooga. You know, and if Nick couldn't kill it, you know, that's a pretty good sign that it's one hell of a town.
Well, Ron, now that you've finished up with the Memphis end of the territory, let's talk a little bit about something outside of wrestling. You mentioned it at the top of the show that you were going to go on a dig. Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing outside of the ring in the summer of 75.
Yeah. So, you know, regular Studcast listeners are very aware of what's been going on with me getting involved in an archaeological dig. It's in Manchester, Tennessee, which is about halfway between Chattanooga, we just talked about, and the city of Nashville. There was a Dr. William Bass at the University of Tennessee, and he was my wife's professor. And he had placed me on this dig so I could be close to my wife and sons over the course of the summer, because she was going to be having to be gone 5 days a week. And so this was a nice deal for me, and I was really appreciative of him giving me this opportunity. And our first week there is going to begin soon, and I'll be returning every Thursday to Knoxville during the course of these digs over the rest of the summer of 1975. To work Thursday night spot shows. We're going to work Friday nights, and we're going to work Saturdays all through 75, 3-day weekends, every weekend. I had no idea what to expect from the archaeological dig, but I'm going to soon find out, because the dig is actually going to begin the first Monday in July of 1975. So we're really going to come back to this dig quite a bit during the course of the summer of 75 that we're talking about here. And people are going to get a little knowledge of what that's all about. And believe me, that's not as easy as it sounds like. That's a pretty darn nasty job, actually. And we'll get into all that pretty soon. But I'd like to go back to Knoxville. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we're reviewing the cards in Knoxville for the week of the 20th of June, and we're going to review the cards, we're going to review the results, we're going to review the TV that set up that card of the 20th, and for the first time, we're going to talk payoffs for the entire 3-day weekend, because it's Southeastern Wrestling's first ever 3-day weekend of wrestling. It's going to begin in Middlesbrough, Kentucky on a Thursday night. On the 20th, that's the 19th of June. On the 20th, the following night's in Knoxville, and then it finishes on Saturday night in a little town called Morristown, about 40-50 miles north of Knoxville. I talked about last week about needing to run three nights in a row in order to keep the big time stars that I was getting at that point, like the Assassin and Tommy Siegler and some pretty decent names. And they needed to have three nights there to make enough money to make it sense for them to come there. So that's why I started doing the 3-day weekend. And then this first 3-day weekend, as I said, begins in Middlesbrough, Kentucky on Thursday night, June 19th, 1975. We're running in the National Guard Army. And it's fairly inexpensive rent, as most National Guard armies are. This is the card for not only Thursday that weekend, but also 2 days later for the Saturday night in Morristown. They're both going to have the identical cards. And they will actually have the same finishes, too, because if the finishes are good, there was no need to change them. Because the good point about it is Southeastern at this point is basically just Knoxville. These two cities of Middlesbrough and Morristown, Tennessee, are separated by 100 miles. And we're a small company at this point, and we don't have a lot of fans who are traveling and following us from town to town. So you don't have to worry about changing finishes, and you don't have to worry about changing cards that much. That's going to change down the road when the business there becomes so popular that fans are just going to follow us 7 nights a week if we wanted to run 7 nights a week. So let's just jump on it. What's the card for Middlesbrough, Kentucky, and Morristown, Tennessee on that weekend of June 20th, 75? First match is Les Thatcher against Rick Connors. Connors is a pretty good worker, a Knoxville boy. Actually trained a whole lot of wrestlers in that area. And him and Les have a tremendous match. Les is over pretty much everywhere because he's a commentator now. He's seen on every show, and he's seen most of the show. So he's becoming an even bigger star. I don't like to use him in Knoxville much, but I don't mind using him on these small towns. But he was paid basically for doing the commentary. That's how he got paid, is basically from Friday night's card, because that's where the money was made, in Knoxville rather than in the smaller towns, especially at this point. Obviously, Les won that opening match in both of those cities. The Assassin worked against the former Inferno, Rocky Smith. Hell of a combination of talent right there. Really, really, two really good guys. And they're going to be in the same match on both those nights. And these matches were very good because Rocky Smith's a really well-respected wrestler around the country. And that's because of his run with the Infernos and his manager, J.C. Dykes. They were a tremendous three-man combination. And these two, the Assassin and Rocky Smith, could put in some time and still have a great match. And that's exactly what they did. The Assassin won both the matches, obviously, in both those cities. There was a tag match with Tommy Sigler and Don Wright against George McCreary and Tony Peters. Tony Peters is a big guy who's trained by the Wright brothers out of the same area up there, the Tri-Cities. And you know who Tommy Sigler is, new star there. Don Wright, obviously, and George McCreary has been there for a few weeks with us. Sigler and Don Wright were the winners. Obviously, they're going to win that match. The main event was booked prior to my losing the title in both of these two cities. I was the champion when we booked these, but then in the meantime, I lost the championship to Ron Wright. And the only good thing about that is when they were introducing that match for the championship, it was supposed to be a championship match, they announced that I had lost the belt 10 days earlier. And the crowd cheered. They were happy. I mean, you know, if I'd have been a babyface and lost the match, it'd have been a whole different situation. But I'm a heel, and they were so happy to hear that, hell, that somebody beat him for the Southern Championship. They all cheered about it. And that was a good deal because, it wasn't a championship match, but the crowd didn't care. But they were happy with the fact that I was no longer champion. And so it's one of those rare times when it pays to be a heel. So I really realized that for the first time when they started doing all that booing. So I didn't want to beat top guys in these spot shows. So we had a double DQ, and there was no winner in these two matches, in both Morristown and in Middlesbrough. The fans loved the match, and we had to have that because we were working in these small cities regularly. I started from the very beginning talking to the guys every night about we're going to have to run these small towns to make sure. I wanted those guys to realize that these small towns are important. A lot of guys in bigger territories, they wrestle in the big cities, and when they go to a small town, they don't work very hard because they may not be back there ever again. Well, in this territory of Knoxville, it's a unique territory. It's going to have one big town. It's going to have another town that runs regularly on Tuesdays, which will eventually be Johnson City. But the rest of the territory, 4 nights a week, is going to be in small towns. And every time you go there, you got to rock it. You've got to really get the crowd. You cannot go there and act like, well, this town is not important. And I pushed that fact, and I had to do that for the next 4 years. I never, ever let my wrestlers think that, hey, this is a small town and it's a night off. There's no such thing as a night off in wrestling.
All right, so you're talking about small towns. How small are you talking? Like Middlesbrough and, at this time, Morristown, how many fans are you getting in there, and how much money are you making?
Well, we drew about the size of the sounds. Let's say Middlesbrough, Kentucky, and at that point, I'm going to guess, was probably less than 20,000 population. of Morristown, maybe less than 30,000 population. They're not big cities by any stretch of imagination. We drew about 600 fans in Middlesbrough on a Thursday night. Now, we're going to draw better on a Saturday night because that's just natural. It's going to happen everywhere. But on this Thursday night, we draw 600 fans in Middlesbrough. And ticket prices are extremely cheap. Ringside's $3. General admission for adults is $2. And for children is just $1. Gross house was about $1,600. The payoff was only about $450 total. That's at 30%. I never paid myself for wrestling in any of these towns until my company started making a good profit. That benefited the boys because my payoff, I just threw in there. I didn't take a payoff, but my money was in the pot, and it made a little more money for everybody who was on the card. I didn't tell guys that I was doing this, but it didn't make any difference. So, you know, that it wouldn't have concerned them. And I think they should have been happy. They were making more money without me taking that payoff myself. There were 10 guys and a referee on that card, a total of 11. And when I took my payoff out, I did not take a payoff. That means the 10 guys are going to split that 450. And guys on the bottom of the card, the Rick Connors, the Rocky Smith, the Tony Peters, the George McCrary, and the referee, Mac, got $35 each. Not a lot of money, but back in those days, it's not bad. You can get yourself a hotel room for $15, $20 a night. The top guys, Les Thatcher and the Assassin, Tommy Siegler, Don Wright, and Ron Wright, they got $55. Man, you know, we're going to look at Friday night's Knoxville, but let's take a look at what happened on Saturday. Kind of skip Knoxville. We'll come back to Knoxville on June the 20th in 1975. But on the 21st, on the Saturday night following Knoxville, we were in Morristown. Now, it's a little bigger population. It's a Saturday night. We drew about 1,000 people. It was a gross house of 3,000, a payroll of about $900. Same bottom guys were in Morristown, got about $75, and the same card, and the same top guys got about $105. And if you notice, Brian, that I'm paying about 30% in the spot shows, and I'm going to pay 28% in Knoxville because obviously Knoxville is grossing much more than the spot shows, and it's going to provide a bigger payoff for all the boys. So 30% in the little towns, 28% in Knoxville. I'm paying as good as anybody in the country, maybe better than anybody in the country at this point.
Well, Ron, let's take a break here. This seems like a good place, and we will return in a second with that card that you just skipped over, the Knoxville card for June 20th, 1975. But first, a word about the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 20 with the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Idol.
The Stud has a remarkable group of famous wrestling friends for 40 or more years that are super Studcast personalities at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. From Andre the Giant, Terry Funk, and Stan Hansen to the Honky Tonk Man, Bullet Bob Armstrong, Kevin Sullivan, and many more. All of these fantastic talents have one thing in common. They represent old school wrestling, and all were one of the best to ever set foot in the wrestling ring. Super Studcast number 20 is no exception, as Ron opens the door to his 50-year friend, the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Idol. Welcome all patrons to part one of another classic Super Studcast, as Austin Idol talks about everything from his Florida snake pit memories to the fateful 1975 plane crash that took the life of Bobby Shane and badly injured Buddy Colt, Gary Hart, and himself. Saddle up at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. For this chilling and thrilling 3-hour Super Studcast that will undoubtedly become another record breaker.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 20, direct from a penthouse in Las Vegas, the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Idol. Hear everything he has to say. This one deals with some real serious issues, but this one is also filled with a lot of fun. Check it out today, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. For only $2.99, you get in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling. We'll have more about that later in the show. But Ron, let's return to this period of time, the end of June 1975. You just talked about Middlesbrough, Kentucky, Morristown, Tennessee. We skipped over Knoxville. What's going on in Knoxville?
Well, let's take a look at that card of June the 20th. And then we'll take a look at the results, too. And then we'll break down the TV. of the June 14th, which was the Saturday before the June 20th night of wrestling. And that TV is the one that's going to promote that June 20th card. So this is the card and results for Friday, June 20th, 1975 at Chilhowie Park. The opening match was the old, and now I'm going to say that politely at this point, the old and very experienced veteran Sputnik Monroe against Devoy Brunson. Sputnik always made his matches entertaining, and he did so on this night as well. It was one of his first appearances. He's going to work for me about 5 weeks in a row here, and I want to get him over. So he won a very good opening match, and he certainly entertained fans as he always did. He always had a way of getting himself over, especially if you talked to him. And I had a little conversation and said, you know, I want to use you here, and I want to try to put you over for a few weeks and then beat you maybe the last weekend. And he appreciated that. So Don Wright, second match was against George McCrary. They went about 20 minutes, and it was a pretty good match. Don Wright won it. Tommy Siegler, who's the big-time new babyface, went next versus a good veteran in Lorenzo Perini. Siegler continued his wins and was starting to get over at this point. You could see that he's going to be a star. There was a double main event that night. The Mongolian Stomper, who was the Southern champion at this point, managed by Bearcat Wright, defended his title against Ron Wright. And this one was a barn burner, and the Stomper's last appearance in Knoxville until 1977, when he's going to come back and become part of the crew for Southeastern. So, you know, there's a phenomenal guy right there that I really wanted. Not able to get him at this point. Just don't have a territory. Don't have big enough happenings in my town to be able to afford him. But by 1977, I'm going to lay my hands on one of the best workers in the world. Stomper lost that match to Ron Wright by disqualification, and Ron got his hand raised. It was a good win for Ron, and I needed him to remain strong as a babyface for me. We recorded this match so we could edit it down and get all the good spots where Ron Wright was looking great. We didn't show the finish because it was a disqualification, but we did show the referee raising Wright's hand as a winner at the end of the video. So we're going to use that for our television program, and it's going to be beneficial, obviously. Last match was the Tennessee Tag Championship match with me and the Assassin against Jimmy Golden and Ricky Gibson, who were champions, the young studs at this point. And it was a 60-minute time limit match, best two out of three falls. We traded falls, and this one was won by Golden and Gibson via disqualification because we got counted out on the third fall. It was a wild match with a lot of fighting outside the ring, and that's going to lead to the return match the following Friday night, 27th, for the Tennessee tag titles. But this time it's going to be with lumberjack rules the next Friday night, which meant wrestlers going to be stationed on the floor around the ring to throw the participants back in when they jump out or when the wrestlers throw them out. So we also recorded the last fall of this match to show how much activity there was on the outside of the ring. That's the one on the 20th, in which it's just for the championship. It's two out of three falls and 60-minute time. But we did have a lot of fighting on the outside, and we recorded that. We want to show it back and show it as being a reason that it's going to be a lumberjack the next time. We'll come back to finish the card on June 20th with the attendance for that night a little later in the program, for the payoff that night, and also for the total of all three payoffs for that weekend. So after discussing the TV of June 14, 1975, the card that we just discussed, that's what that's all about. And now let's talk a little bit, Brian, about the television program on Saturday, June 14, 1975.
So you're now at WBIR. You've been there for several weeks. Are you feeling comfortable? Do you feel like you're home yet?
Yes. I mean, the program's improving every week. I'm real happy with their commitment to it and all the things that they're doing. This is going to be actually just the fifth show at WBIR. And this show is going to be a little different than the other four preceding it. This will be the first show that we ever work an angle on, a live angle on TV. So let's just jump right into that show. As like I said, this This television show is to promote the card of Friday night, the June the 20th. We've already talked about what that card was and the results. But the TV crew is getting smoother, as I said, and better with each of these new shows. After all four of the first shows, the TV crew met with the director, Bill Kincaid, Les Thatcher, the production manager, and I. We're talking about the cameramen. We're talking about everybody associated with the production. We met after each of these first four shows, and we talked about how we could tighten things up and how we could improve on what the program already looked like. I call this quality control meetings. These quality control meetings, they're going to go on for about 2 months until Les and I are happy with everything that happens on this show. So this was the only time I can remember that these type of meetings with any TV production crews anywhere for me took place until 1985, when Continental Wrestling is going to debut its first live show from Boutwell Auditorium in Birmingham, Alabama. And that program is going to have an all-new commentator, Gordon Solie. It's going to be in a major building rather than in a small studio, and it's going to be worked with an independent production company contractor that's actually got the big trucks that they back them in beside the old Boutwell Auditorium and bring out the six cameras. And it's a tremendous television production. But this one in Knoxville is the first one that we do these quality control meetings. And we're going to not have to do one until 1985. It's pretty amazing. These production meetings that was going on in Knoxville at this point is a great example of the commitment of WBIR-TV and its employees. They wanted to produce the best studio wrestling show in the world, and by golly, they were getting it done. And to get that done, you're smart to have this quality control meetings.
Okay, so you're happy with the production. What about the actual show? What do you do on this episode? I think you said it was the fifth episode on WBIR.
Yeah. Well, we're going to open it up with Tommy Sigler. He's a new babyface. We're going to get him a win with a live match against the former Inferno, Rocky Smith. Good guy to get a job out of, a great worker. Studio fans love this match. And then Tommy, right after the match, goes straight from the ring to the set with Thatcher, and he watches an impressive win he had the night before against Ron Bass. And I went to Ron Bass before this match that night, and I explained to him how important it was to get Sigler over as fast as I could. And I was impressed with how much attention old big Ron Bass paid to me and what I had to say. And then I went and watched the match, and the fans, they really, really got into the match. And then I watched it again, the match on TV, the pieces of it that we showed again, less than 24 hours. And right then, when I watched it on the television show, I put Ron Bass's name in my memory bank, by God. And I decided that he's someone I really wanted to bring back in again to work for me somewhere down the line. And I'm going to do that about 1980-81. Once Southeastern gets into Pensacola. Sigler and Les did a great job of breaking down the recorded match. And by the time the segment was over, Tommy Sigler had just beaten two of the all-time greats in the first segment of that program, Big Ron Bass and the Inferno Rocky Smith. That's the fastest way you could possibly get someone over. He basically got two wins right there on TV, back to back, with two of the greats of all time.
That really is the recipe. It is pretty simple. If you want to get someone over, have them win.
Win, 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 win. And that's really the secret. And if you can have them do something like that and win two matches in one segment of a TV show, that's really pushing to get them over, and you can't help but make it happen. So after the station takes a two-minute commercial break, we return to the set with Tommy's opponent the following Friday night. We've just seen Tommy. He's gotten himself over, and that opponent is Lorenzo Perini. Now, Perini has history in Knoxville. He'd been around there many, many times. Everybody booed him when he came to the set. They know who he is and what he's about. And he did a pretty decent interview about Sigler's youth against his experience. And it was a good opening segment for a show. And this show is about to take off. The second segment of this show is going to be Ron Wright time. I might as well put it that way. It's basically, this is the Ron Wright moment of the day. He got a win on TV against Tony Peters, also from the Tri-Cities. I mentioned him earlier, big old guy, about 6'4", 300 pounds. And Ron let Peters get some heat on him. He's working in a live match on TV, and he lets Peters get a little bit of get him down some, which I think he's trying to help Peters to get a little confidence in himself as a worker. But it's always a key to a great babyface's success. If he sells good, then that comeback is going to be that much better. So, and Ron's an old timer, and he knows what the hell's going on, and he gets Peters, let him get his heat, and then he gets ready for the make his comeback, and he gives him one of them old Tennessee dog whipping comebacks that's going to be everything those fans want. And they loved Ron Wright, and he knew how to work fans in that part of the country. Studio audience is on their feet when that match is over, and old Ron, he didn't let the momentum die. He went straight to the set with Les, and he started out by reminding fans who watched last week's show, the last week's television show, in which Stomper had wrestled against George McCrary and beat him in, I think it was 3 minutes and 47 seconds. He reminded Les. He said, you know, last night I worked against this guy that's the same guy, McCrary, in which he had, it was actually two Fridays earlier, and he had beat McCrary. He made a boast on TV. He says, I'll beat McCrary faster than Stomper beat him on TV. Stomper beat him in 3 minutes and 47 seconds. So he sits there and reminds Les of the time, and then they roll the film that shows his match with McCrary that night, that Friday night, and actually Ron beats him. He goes to the announcer, makes a point when he beats McCrary pretty darn quickly. He goes to the announcer in Chihai Park, and he says, announce the time. And the announcer got the time from the timekeeper, and he said, yes, you've won that match. And you can actually hear the announcer speaking this on the video in three minutes and 37 seconds. And as Wright would do, he looked at Les and said, I told you, Les, studio audience and all those fans out there watching, I could do it. You know, and then he got excited from there, and he went off. I mean, see, Mr. Thatcher, he just went on. I told all these fans last week I could whoop McCrary faster than the Stomper, and I did it. And now I got my shot at the Mongolian, and I ain't about to lose my chance to prove that I'm a better man than he is next Friday night.
Well, the studio fans, they erupt, and they're all into it. But then suddenly, from out of nowhere, here comes the Stomper and his manager, Bearcat Wright, and they just kind of appear at the set. And all of a sudden, Wright's got to shut up. It's like, what's going on here? And for the first time since the TV show had been moved from the old Big Jim Hess station to WBIR, I was going to do a live angle on TV. So Bearcat Wright's trying to hold the Stomper back from getting to Ron Wright. And Ron jumps up to his feet and starts screaming to Bearcat and the Stomper, we ain't got to wait until next Friday. If you boys want a little Tennessee dog whooping, then by God, then you come to the right place. And well, the studio crowd went nuts, sure enough, then. And so did Les Thatcher. I mean, he jumped to his feet and he reached across the desk. He's trying to stop. To keep Bearcat and Stomper from starting something at his desk, his brand new desk. He's so proud of the set and the desk and everything. And he screams at him, wait a minute here. We're not going to have a problem at my desk. And about that same time, Stomper kind of separates himself from Bearcat and gets off to Wright's side. And Bearcat's got Wright's attention, and Stomper nails him. And Ron threw a punch at him, and Stomper grabs him in by the back of his hair and just slams his face into the desk right there by Les. I mean, within just inches of Les's arm, he slams his face right there on the desk. And Bearcat reaches across the desk and nails Ron from behind. And then Stomper moves in and grabs the back of Ron Wright's head, and he raises it and slams it down on the desk a second time. Now Les reaches and grabs the statue at the front of the desk because he sees, man, this we're going to break. They're going to tear up my desk, and they may bust the statue and everything else. And he grabs the statue, and he kind of backs off, and he's still screaming at him, stop, stop. And they just keep going. Stomper raised his right head again after he slammed it down the second time, and, you know, they got a bloody face. I mean, he's bleeding pretty bad. And Bearcat raises Ron's head again, and blood's all over his face. Stomper moves around behind the desk, grabs right, and throws him over the desk onto the concrete floor. And Bearcat drops down on top of him with his body across Ron Wright's arms and the upper part of his body and holds him down. Stomper backs off and takes a little run at him and stomps Ron Wright right in the forehead with his head just nailed down to the concrete. Les screaming for help from the back, and Golden and Gibson appear, and Stomper and Bearcat retreat to the dressing room. Golden and Gibson get the old Ron Wright up, and, you know, they start carrying him off back around the back of the set. And we have our first live angle on Southeastern Wrestling, and I think it's probably going to do business for us at this point.
So you said before that was the first angle you actually did at WBIR since you left the old station?
That's correct. That's correct. Very first one we did, and we wanted to do that on purpose. Les and I talked about it. We did not want to come and present a wrestling show on a brand new television station that had not had wrestling in many, many years, if at all, and I don't believe they'd ever had it. But, you know, we wanted to present wrestling as legitimate, and we wanted to not work any angles intentionally on television. We wanted people to see it as a wrestling show. That's why we had the personality profile in there. It was designed for that and with that in mind, and we waited for 5 weeks to do this angle. If I had been up to Les, he would have said, no, let's don't do it, or he would sure not want to do it right there at his desk. But I felt like it was time. It was summertime, and we're coming in a good time of year. And we had the last opportunity here to do something with the Stomper because he's going to be leaving. So we went ahead and did it. And, you know, I've expressed many times already how important the impact from recorded matches in the arenas are. But there's nothing that has that impact of something out of the ordinary that happens live on your wrestling show. Right there. People ain't expecting it. And wow, look what's happened. What's gone down. That is really a way to have an impact on the fans. And you can tell automatically when something gets over. Man, you've been in the business for a while. You watch it and you hear the crowd and you see what it looks like. And you know what's happening to people at home. You know they're going, wow, oh, look what they're doing to Ron Wright. You know, so this was the first time I'd done anything out of the ordinary since we came to BIR for that reason. I wanted to have just good, solid wrestling programs the first 4 or 5. And I knew this has gotten over. And I really expected that following Friday night that we might be up as many as 1,000 fans from where we had been if it didn't rain. That was always the problem because it was one of the first times I really regretted being outside in the amphitheater because if it rained, it was going to probably cost us as many as 2,000 fans getting turned away because that little inside building at Chillicothe Park only held about 2,000. So the Coliseum was looking better than ever with this rain problem that I'm suffering through in the summer of 75. But we're just not ready yet to make the move to that big building. So this show obviously is off to a pretty great start, but it's not half finished yet. After the TV station commercial break, the Mongolian Stomper and his manager, Bearcat Wright, they come back out to the scene of the crime. They try to sit down and start talking, but Les is still pissed at what's going on. You know, he's trying to put things back together on his desk, and they sit down there, and you can tell by Les's expression that he's not happy with what's going on here. He's never happy with live angles on the shows, very rarely. He wants everything to be wrestling as much as possible. But I'm going to drive him crazy in the next 4 years because I like to do these live angles every once in a while. We almost have words on occasion. There are times when Les... I would do one of these on the end of the show and everybody in the studio, and I guarantee you everybody at home in their living rooms are just standing up, but they're ever going crazy at the end of it. And he would throw in this little remark he would always say, and sometimes I would be there at the desk with him, and he'd say, oh boy, it looks like another Nick Gulas production, Ron. I wanted to reach over there and choke him sometimes. I understood what he was saying, and it was just his way of throwing it in and getting his little spot in there. But this program is really cooking at this point, though. So he can't avoid showing his anger for criticizing, and he starts criticizing Bearcat right about what's happened. I mean, what did you do that for? And you don't have to come out here. And so Bearcat, he's a consummate professional, and he ignores Les's attitude, and starts the early victory celebration with the Stomper about what just happened and how it's going to affect the outcome of next Friday night's match. And Ron Wright's already bloodied today, and we can't wait to bloody him up again next Friday night. And Bearcat blames the entire brutal incident that just happened on Ron Wright's interference the night before, and 2 weeks before, actually, on the Friday night when Stomper was working with Ron Wright's brother, Don Wright. And I remember Don Wright got his hands on Bearcat that night. And as Bearcat put it, Ron Wright had laid his hands on the wrong man. And the night before, he made it personal between those two guys right there. He made it personal that Ron Wright had put your hands on me when Stomper's wrestling your brother. And now when we come out here, I wanted to do this, and I'm glad that it happened. And, they really got a tremendous amount of heat. And when he made it personal between him and Ron Wright, that gave him a lot of heat. And standing behind him while he's doing all this mouthing off is his weapon back there, the big Mongolian standing behind him. And the studio crowd makes their presence known during the entire interview. You can hardly hear what he's saying. And we're two segments in, and I'm like, wow, this is going to be a great show.
Well, Ron, that's a lot. You really loaded up with hot stuff at the top of the show. Two questions. One, how do you continue with the show after that when you have so much hot material at the top of the show? And two, this is usually around the time of the show where you would have the personality profile, I would assume. So who's on the personality profile on this episode?
Well, we're going to make Les happy here. We're going to tone it down a little bit. And I'd set it up that way on purpose because I figure Les, well, at this point, he'll be pretty livid about, oh, God, this is just going to be too much. And so the personality profile is with the legendary Sputnik Monroe. And just as I'd done with Tommy Sigler the week before, that he was, before he even worked his first match, he was on the personality profile and he was wearing a suit. I told Sputnik to wear a suit. And he wasn't even on the card the night before, Sputnik. I said, I want you to come in and do the TV for me as a favor. I want to put you on a segment called The Personality Profile. Wear yourself a suit. And he did. And Monroe looked very, very good in the suit. I was really amazed. And Les was really well prepared, as always. And he's asking a bunch of great questions during this personality profile about Monroe's fantastic career and also about his role as a spokesman for blacks around the world long before that became a big issue. Monroe had made civil rights issues a big thing in Memphis long before it happened in most cities. But Les asked him about his career, and then he took it to the next level by giving Monroe credit for integrating the wrestling arena in Memphis, which was the Ellis Auditorium at that time. It was before Mid-South Coliseum was even built. And it was one of the first places in all of the South that had an integrated building long before it became common. So he finished with the fact that Sputnik had participated in the finals of a Cadillac tournament in Memphis in 1959 that had drawn one of the largest crowds in the history of the sport. And again, as in the week before, the personality profile was exactly what Les and I had envisioned it being. And it was proving to be one of the highlights of every show. I mean, it was, we would come off of a big angle and right away we go into something that's as solid as a wrestler in a suit talking about civil rights. It's a long way from wrestling, a long way from what happened in that second segment, but it was a great way to continue the program, tone things down, and get it back under control.
How does the remainder of the show go, Ron?
Third segment, I'm going to put Sputnik in the ring live.
Now, the personality profile is cut pre-cut, so it's in a separate studio. And when they go to the ring to announce this match, and Monroe now is not in a suit, but he's in wrestling tights. And to people who watch the show, that's only 2 minutes break between that personality profile and that match. Les is smart, sharp enough that once he's introduced, Les says, hey, I want fans to know that we pre-produce these personality profiles. And that's why you see Sputnik now dressed to wrestle, is because we did the profile earlier this morning. That's going to come to our work and our benefit down the road, because we're going to even work angles off of personality profiles. So this is a good thing for Les, and he's really quick to pick up on this. So now he's in the ring with Devoy Brunson and the Assassin. And I did an interview after that match about the very unusual Tennessee tag match defense for a second week in a row with a 60-minute time limit and 2 out of 3 falls match with Jimmy Golden and Ricky Gibson, and how we're coming back the following week in a lumberjack match. And speaking of the young guns, there's where our last match is going to be. We're going to bring that Jimmy Golden and Ricky Gibson out. They're going to parade through the crowd and get everybody on their feet. They're going to go in the ring and have a tremendous match with Tony Peters and George McCrary. And studio and audience is just really, really into the match, just like they were the week before. And then the two champions after that match go straight to the desk, and they're going to take the last interview. And they tore the house down with the last interview, had a tremendous interview talking about me and the Assassin, and how there's going to be people around the ring to toss them back in, us back into them, so that they can get the pin instead of us crawling out and trying to get away. Great interview. Fans really got into it. And those young boys are really becoming a confident team, and they're getting more accustomed to working on top.
Well, Ron, we are getting close to time to wrap things up this week on the show. But before we do, two things. You mentioned that you would talk about the payoffs for all the wrestlers for the 3-day weekend. But before you get there, how did this TV show do? How did it translate into box office for the show that you ran at Chill Howie Park on Friday, June 20th?
Well, the crowd was up again. I mean, we're experiencing larger crowds each week. We're in the amphitheater. We got some decent weather on the 20th. We have around 3,000 fans. Today, as I promised, for the first time ever on the Studcast, we're going to break down the payoffs for that first ever three-city Southeastern weekend. And I don't normally like to focus on payoffs, but, we've had a whole lot of fans that have requested me. You know, they're just curious about how much the wrestlers make back in that time frame, and how did you pay? So we're going to break down this Knoxville house of June 20th that had about 3,000 fans, which been in gross attendance of about $9,000. There's an average per ticket price of $3 each. The payoff total is going to be 28% of that 9,000, which is going to be about $2,500 divided by the 13 people. I'm the 14th, but I'm not going to be paid. That broke down to an average of about 200 per wrestler, not counting me, because I wasn't taking the payoff. And the bottom guys on the card, Devoy Brunson, George McCrary, Lorenzo Perini, Don Wright, and then the referee, got $100 each. The guys that I considered on this card to be middle of the card payoffs, and there's two of them on this particular card. Sputnik Runro is one, and Stomper's manager is Bearcat Wright. Now, Stomper's manager, obviously, is not going to make what Stomper makes, but I pay those guys $125 each. And the top six on this card, Tommy Sigler, Mongolian Stomper, Ron Wright, Jimmy Golden, Ricky Gibson, and the Assassin, they get $300. These payoffs are going to be, they're going to vary greatly over the coming years as the talent level in Southeastern rises. A 3-day weekend total for a top guy just 1 year later, as an example, in 1976, is going to double what this figure that we're going to talk about in just a second was. And it will triple by 1977. So, you know, business is just going to continue to grow dramatically. And this is a small payoff compared to what's going to happen in 76 and 77. There will become a time in Southeastern and Continental out of Pensacola in the 1980s when every wrestler on the card from top to bottom are going to all be main eventers. And when that happens, all wrestlers on the card, when I'm paying, will be paid the same, no matter where they are on the card. First match is going to make the same money as last match. And that's a great pay scale. That type of pay scale is very popular with main eventers in my territories over the years. And it kept top wrestlers happy. They didn't care whether they were in the main event or first match. They knew their money was going to be identical or very close to identical from whoever was up there. So to close out today's episode, I've added up the total payoffs for all three cities that ran that weekend of June the 20th, 1975. The bottom guys made $210 for three nights, and the top guys made about $460. And Brian, can you give me some idea of what that might equate to in today's money just for the top guys, let's say?
Well, the bottom guys, give me that number one more time.
$210.
That translates in 2019 to $999.81, so almost $1,000.
Jeez, man, not too bad. And the top guys made $460.
$460 at 1975 translates in 2019 dollars to $2,190.07.
Jeez. So, you know, that's 3 days. They've been there Thursday, Friday, Saturday. They stayed in a hotel Thursday night and Friday night, Saturday night to go home. That's a pretty darn decent 3 days. And you can, if you just double and triple those figures, you get an idea about what they're going to make in three nights in 1977, 1976, and 77. The territory is really going to go places. And this is a pretty good starting range here. And that translates in enough money to get yourself some good talent.
Well, Ron, as we wrap things up, we want to remind the listeners on Facebook, become friends with the Tennessee Stud, the page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. All you got to do is go there and like that page, and instantly you're friends with a wrestling legend. On Twitter and Instagram, you can follow the Stud at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcast. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts for classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. We want to mention it one more time this week. The latest Super Studcast out now, Super Studcast number 20, with the Universal Heartthrob Austin Idol. Almost 90 minutes of hilarity, as well as some real deep stuff, some stuff about the snake pit. And he goes into detail, not just about the plane crash, but explains it in detail to Ron, who never really heard the whole story before. You got to hear this today. TNstud.com or Patreon.com/Studcast. And thank you to all the patrons for continuing to support the production of the Studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, talent changes quickly in Knoxville, and it's going to happen in summer of 75, and it will begin in next week's, basically. Less than 2 weeks, Ricky Gibson's going to be gone. Jimmy Golden, too, is going to be gone in less than a month. The talented heels from Atlanta, Rock Hunter, Frank Morrell are going to be coming in. We're going to take a look at the next week at the next show, at the next three-day weekend of June 27, 1975. I'm going to be returning to Florida in June 30th of 1975, and working in West Palm Beach against Bob Roop for the Florida title on Monday night. And Tuesday, I'm going to travel to Tampa. And Tuesday night, I'm going to wrestle for the Southern title against Carl Krupp. So I'm going to spend a couple of nights in Florida next program. And things are really starting to roll now in the summer 1975, and can't wait to jump on the rest of it.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains.